and welcome to this Innovation Forum webinar. I'm Ian Welsh, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so. Today, we are going to be talking about the future of ethical trade, compliance, and the human rights risks that brands must address. There have been major changes in human rights, due diligence, and reporting in recent years, and governments are creating legislation that holds businesses legally accountable. In addition, NGOs, investors, and consumers are demanding more than just the bare minimum when it comes to business and human rights practices. But is the basic question of what do stakeholders actually want getting lost? To help unpick these and other issues, I'm joined by an expert panel this afternoon. I'm joined with Julie Vallée, Vice President Human Rights at L'Oreal, Adam Schaefer, Director of Supply Chain Traceability with Intel, and Mary Francis, Senior Manager, Worker Rights Strategy at BF Corporation. And my thanks to my Innovation Forum colleague, Kate Chandler, for helping to convene our discussion today. What we're talking about will, of course, also be part of the discussion at Innovation Forum's Ethical Trade and Human Rights Conference Series this spring. We'll be in London on 18th and 19th of March, and in New York on the 5th and 6th of May. Full details of the already impressive participant lineups and how to attend are on the Innovation Forum website and can be found via the Q codes on your screen now. Okay, I will shortly invite our panelists to answer some opening questions to kick things off. We will have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open the debate up to audience questions. We do want to hear from you all, so please submit questions using the box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to the panel. Please try and keep your questions short and to the point, and if you do, it is more likely that I will use them. As usual for Innovation Forum sessions, we have no presentations today, just discussion. We are recording the audio, though, and you will receive a link to this in due course when it is edited and published on the Innovation Forum podcast channel. Okay, turning to our panel. Julie from L'Oreal, what are the main human rights risks that your company faces now, and what do your stakeholders expect you to do about them? Julie.
Thank you for this good question. One of the main risks we are facing at L'Oreal is to make sure that when we are sourcing raw material for our products, for the use of our products, be it renewable raw materials or mineral raw materials, we have to make sure that there is no human rights breaches along the value chain and the supply chain, be it forced labor, child labor, working conditions, and other human rights issues. And this has been, highlighted by some of our stakeholders and also some of our partners. We are working, for example, with the Danish Institute for Human Rights, and they are helping us to again, identify our human rights gap. And this one is one of the risks we are working on.
Okay. How are the incentives that you have for going beyond compliance? How are you finding these incentives are changing?
More and more, our stakeholders, widely speaking, be it NGOs, civil society, consumers, they are expecting us to go beyond pure legal compliance. And for example, going back to supply chain, we are, you know, subjected to many laws, including the French law on devoir de vigilance. And the French law on devoir de vigilance, you know, is really focused on tier one. And our stakeholders want us to go beyond tier one. And for example, when we are using palm oil derivative products or mica based products, we are going beyond tier one.
Fine. How are you finding that the internal conversations that you've had, are they getting easier now? I mean, human rights issues have been around for some time. We've been talking about them for some time, and there's been an acceptance that there are risks for every business. Are you finding discussing these issues with your colleagues is becoming easier?
Indeed, many things are moving, and customers are helping us to bring this to the table. So it's really going beyond the pure legal framework, and it's coming from various ways, including from investors, from banks, from pension funds, and for example, the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark Initiative or other related initiatives are very positive insights for internal discussion.
Okay, great. Well, I think we can come back to some of the initiatives and the benchmarks and the tools that that you can use. We can come back to them a little bit later on. But for now, Julie, thank you very much indeed. Let me turn to Adam Schaefer from Intel. Adam, same questions to you. What are the main human rights risks that Intel faces, and what do your stakeholders expect you to do about them?
Sure. Thank you, Ian. The main human rights issues are very similar to what Julie talked about at Intel, because we're an electronics manufacturer and we are primarily B2B, although we do have certainly a brand and some retail. We have multiple supply chains that we are considering. And when you talk about the main issues, there are the supply chains for our manufacturing factories, and human rights issues there can be similar to what was just talked about in terms of the sourcing, mineral sourcing for metals around the world. We've had a very strong program for the last 10 years on conflict minerals specifically. But the impact on human rights within the mineral sourcing is not limited to the narrowly defined conflict minerals, but really the rest of the periodic table and really the rest of the globe in those spaces. And really extending to chemicals that we use in our manufacturing, both from an environmental impact and occupational health and safety space there, certainly strong human components. And then, as I said, we're an electronics company. So, like many of our brands that we're serving, or the products that we are working with, there's a lot of outsourced manufacturing. So, a lot of original device manufacturers in different parts of the world, and there you have issues of foreign migrant workers, which is not unique to our industry, but is certainly part of that and has been fairly prominent. You also have issues around shift work, long working hours issues, as well as kind of the same type of occupational health and safety, but it's at a distance, so you need to be even more diligent about those kinds of controls and safety. So those are the places we look at human rights touching sustainability across our, I would say, supply chains, not just supply chain.
Thank you very much. You're obviously conflict minerals issue is one that's been had a lot of interest in over the past few years. How's that been changing? What are the kind of main initiatives that come into the conflict minerals area and have, you know, really shifted the needle in terms of engagement with workers in the supply chains?
There's a couple different things. You know, mining is inherently difficult and dangerous and dirty. I personally was in Central Africa in December and saw some of the work on the ground that's happening, where the schemes associated with tracking and traceability for minerals are working, and other places where maybe they're not working. And so some of the things that I think, to answer your question in terms of what's evolving, what's evolving in the space where systems are growing and maturing, there's a real concern about gaps. So what is the involvement and the participation for local governments? Concerns around corruption are something you can find and read about all over the place, but really concerns of part of the flip side of corruption is getting the right inspectors to show up so that you're effective. Your traceability schemes, which are designed to be effective, can actually be implemented across all levels of mineral supply chain, from artisanal mining up through industrial mining. So it's really that execution and effectiveness that's being challenged. And then the other way it's developing, as we've seen, as I'm sure some of my colleagues here have talked about, other controversial sourcing, whether it's mica or palm oil or cocoa or some other things like that, where that conflict minerals approach has been both a learning and a teaching tool, where we're seeing things in this industry that we need to learn from and do better on, and we're hopefully showing some of the things that have been successful in those areas, and developing technology needs like electric cars and consumer electronics are increasing the use of materials like a cobalt, which has not been considered a conflict mineral. It's not covered in any of the legislation. But, you know, using the word compliance there doesn't necessarily mean just to laws and regulations. It also means to what is the compliance to your customer demands. And the traceability of cobalt has really been accelerated in the last 2 years at, I would say, 5x the pace of where we were with some of the other minerals 10 years ago.
Sure, and I guess cobalt would be an example of a mineral where the human rights risks perhaps are becoming greater because the demand is going through the roof.
Exactly, and there's where risks are oftentimes is partly is just that it's a supply demand and technical problem. It's where those minerals actually are in the world, how they're discovered, how they're dug up, what is the infrastructure around that, and then what is the global and geopolitical forces around that supply chain.
Sure. Okay, and I'll come back to you just in a sec. Yep. Audience, thank you already for the questions that are coming in. Do be thinking of your questions and do put them in the questions box on the dashboard. I'll put them to the panel a little bit later on. Okay, Adam, coming back to you, thinking about then incentives for change, how are you finding the incentives for you to go beyond compliance around human rights issues are changing?
There's a couple things. I think where many of the programs from companies that have been doing strong work for years is going from compliance, even the word compliance really meant to rules and regulations, whether it's through your governments or consortia that you're part of. Now I think compliance is, are you complying to the expectations? So what used to be above and beyond is now table stakes, and you have a lens of we're all here talking about human rights and helping people, but it's really a risk. What is a risk to your supply chain? What is a risk to those people in your supply chain? What is your risk to business continuity around those things? And risk gets the attention of a whole new set of stakeholders. Be they investors who, again, lots of investors want to do the right thing, but even more investors want to evaluate a company's risk in their supply chains and their ability to create and deliver products. So I think if there's anything that's been the change is the word compliance really meaning that not just complying to rules, but complying to expectations.
Thank you. Well, that's a great definition. Let's come back to some of that a little bit later on.
Sure.
Finally, let me turn to Mary, Mary Francis from VF Corporation. Same question to you, Mary. What are the main human rights risks that your company faces, and what do your stakeholders expect you to do about them? Mary.
Sure. Thank you, Ian. In the apparel and footwear sector, human rights risks vary depending on the level of production. And production in the apparel and footwear supply chain is typically not owned by the brand, and brands rely on third-party contractors to source, produce, and manufacture the final product. The final product is then sent to the brand, which we send to the final consumer. And in this type of supply chain, human rights risks are not in the direct control of multinational brands, but are controlled by the manner in which each factory or tier in a complex global supply chain operates. Brands and multinational organizations like the VF Corporation use our buying power to influence and create change throughout contracted supply chains without direct control of on-the-ground situation. So at VF, we're strengthening our due diligence practices to align with international guidance and best practices. Part of that shift includes scoping and assessing human rights risks throughout our supply chain down to the commodity level. And in addition to compliance audits, we conduct regular human rights risk assessments to better understand the potential of the human rights risks we encounter. And we're conducting deep dive assessments into human rights at the commodity level and in forced labor. We consult with our external stakeholders to better understand these risks and have a robust traceability program so we can understand where our business risks touch those risks. We also increase the amount of supply chain information we disclose to the public, and by doing that, our external stakeholders are better able to supplement our compliance audits and inform us when risks are identified so that we are then able to deploy expertise to mitigate the situations. Our due diligence has shown, similar to the other sectors here, that potential human rights risks focus on forced labor and child rights and occupational safety and health and working wages and freedom of association. And using evidence from our compliance audits, risks assessments, traceability, and stakeholder consultations, we have a more wholesome evidence-based understanding of the risks we might encounter. And it provides us with a clear understanding of where we need to focus our efforts to prevent and mitigate these human rights risks. Broadly speaking, our civil society and government and investor stakeholders increasingly expect us to put in place policies and processes to prevent, mitigate, and remediate these human rights risks. This expectation goes well beyond compliance, and rightfully so. Compliance is a critical component of due diligence, and it can identify instances of human rights violations at specific points in time and specific factories, allowing for companies to remediate violations as they occur. But because traditional compliance can't catch all violations, our stakeholders expect us to follow due diligence practices. And you know, those are really outlined in the UN Guiding Principles and on Business and Human Rights and the OECD Guidance for Multinational Enterprises, both of which were developed with stakeholder input and have excellent guidance on due diligence. So really, you know, those are the standards that we try to adhere to, that we do adhere to. And by adhering to these principles, we're better able to meet our stakeholder expectations, including meeting the demands of due diligence legislation. I think importantly, stakeholders expect industry to be transparent and communicative about their processes, and traceability and transparency help to drive accountability throughout our supply chain and offer consumers more information when making their purchasing decisions. And I think consumers also want to know where their products are manufactured, how they're made, and the environmental impacts of their products and where their raw materials originate.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Mary. The relationship with your suppliers is clearly a crucial one, and one I imagine is changing. Can you give us a little bit of insight as to how you've managed to persuade your suppliers to engage on these issues? And also with your colleagues internally, price is obviously a major factor in the apparel sector. How have you spoken to your colleagues to get them to engage with factories, not just on price, but on human rights issues too?
Sure. Well, you know, we have workers on the ground in most of our sourcing countries, and we engage directly with our suppliers to try and improve the worker rights within our factories. And we also work across VF functions through sourcing and supply chain to implement better buying practices so that we're making sure that the decisions we make aren't perpetuating human rights risks.
Sure. And have your suppliers, do you find them, are they engaging with you? Is it something that they recognize was a concern for them? Or is it kind of a new thing when you first have these conversations?
Well, of course, it depends on the supplier. I think VF has an advantage in that 80% of our sourcing comes from 20% of our factories. So we have better leverage to talk with our suppliers about our expectations and what we'd like to see done.
Sure. Okay. Moving then to think about incentives, how have you found that the incentives for you as a business to go beyond simple compliance have changed?
Well, I think that's a bit of a tricky question. So VF is a purpose-led company, and we want our business to support the betterment of our people and our planet. That's included in our purpose. So for VF, the biggest incentive to go beyond compliance is the desire to ensure that our business does not cause adverse impact, human rights impacts. Rather, we're looking to support decent working conditions and inclusive and sustained economic growth for the over 6 million people that our supply chain touches. So, you know, I think VF has a bias for action, isn't in a state of continuous improvement, and data over time supports more fulsome due diligence, and that gives us enough incentive to evolve how we conduct our due diligence.
Great, okay. A question for all of the panel. I'll come to you each in turn. In terms of the way you're engaging with on on ethical trade issues and human rights. Do you accept that it's a case of constant improvement and that you're never really done in these matters? It's something that you really have to constantly be on top of, and because there is an inherent necessity to accept that there are going to be human rights risks in your in supply chains, and it's a question of always just trying to find them. Julie, let's come back to you on that.
No, it's a good question. I think there are improvements, but it's not always easy, as the other panelists explained, because we are operating in very complex supply chains. If I go back to MiCA, you know, L'Oréal is not a big player regarding MiCA or regarding palm oil. So to make sure that these improvements are really constant, I think what is working is promoting, you know, a multilateral and multi-stakeholder approach. For example, going back to MiCA, you know, there is an initiative called Responsible MiCA Initiative, where you have different kinds of businesses on board, including L'Oréal, but also other players, NGOs, and they want to have more and more governments, authorities on board. So this is kind of a business model which is really working to strive improvement.
Thanks. Adam, same to you. How do you sort of maintain the momentum for constant improvement, constantly looking for the new things that are new problems that are arising?
Yeah, I think for human rights, the model I use is safety. And so, you know, I jokingly say I've done all the math and I know exactly the number of injuries and deaths I want to have on my facilities and campuses around the world. And that's, of course, zero. And so that doesn't mean with working at a big company, that means we're not going to have any safety issues. We're not going to have any accidents or incidents. However, having an accident or an incident within a strong safety program doesn't impugn the quality of that program necessarily. What it does is it allows you to learn and improve. And I think if you take that same model to human rights, as you do see improvements and you do see maturities, you can do a couple of different things. And I think as Julie mentioned about going deeper into the supply chain, than you have before, that growing level of maturity allows you to do that. And so solving one problem doesn't mean necessarily that there's always going to be another problem around the corner. What it means is you can dig deeper and you can look around more and more corners to continually to get halfway to the wall to try to improve the situation. And then I would completely concur that no matter how big your company is, we all have vast supply chains, and our influence is uneven. There are places where we do a lot of business, and I can greatly influence their programs and policies. There are places where I have suppliers and customers who are the same company, and we're very well aligned. There's other suppliers who maybe I inherit through an M&A, or I'm not doing a lot of business with, and there's the number of calories per dollar in that business relationship can be very skewed in terms of what needs to be done in those places. So it does depend, but I do think that it is a continuing and maturing cycle that I'm also quite optimistic with, that we are improving, we are seeing those results, and that I think getting back to your other questions earlier about telling that story internally, that means that you are finding and solving problems at a much faster pace than maybe you did a few years ago.
Thanks, Adam. And Mary, same question to you. How do you ensure at VF Corporation that you're constantly improving, constantly looking for the new human rights issues that will occur, and you know, accepting that, as I said, that you're never really done. It's a constant improvement required. Mary?
Sure, yeah, constant improvement is required. And even if you can identify human rights risks and put in place the mechanisms to prevent and mitigate and remediate them, the human rights risks themselves are shifting. So I think having a constant and cyclical process for identifying the human rights risks and then working to build out the processes to prevent and mitigate them as they change is part of that continuous cycle of due diligence. And then, as the other speakers have said, going down deeper in your supply chain as traceability is built out and your visibility into what the risks are expands, that changes how you conduct due diligence as well.
Sure. Great. Okay. Thank you again for your questions, audience. Please do keep them coming in. I'm going to turn to them now, and we'll get through as many as we can. I will lump them together in themes, I think, to try to get as many points answered as we can. The first one I want to look at is some practical steps. We've heard a lot so far about due diligence and supply chains and performing due diligence checks and supply chains. So how does that, or what does that process look like? How do you go about it? Julie, perhaps you could answer that one. Just what does due diligence look like, and what are the steps to ensure that you are being, you know, have a process of due diligence in place?
Yes. Just before answering this point, I just wanted to add, you know, that solutions are not always easy. Going back to MiCA, we could have alternative solutions. So meaning stop buying and sourcing MiCA anymore. However, thanks to the civil society and NGOs we've been engaging with, they said, no, please don't stop sourcing because it's very important for the region at stake in India. They are very poor and it's a very important source of income. So if you stop sourcing or going to alternative solutions, this might not be the solution. I just wanted to point that out.
Sure.
So going back to your question, due diligence is indeed critical, and again, it's very, very important to break internally the silo. You know, big groups all have silo, so it's critical to work all together to do this due diligence. So not going isolated, you know, with anti-corruption on one side, safety on another side, human rights on another side, environment. So really having a holistic approach as far as we can. It's not always easy, huh? And there are some specificities and differences between human rights and corruption. However, having kind of common ground to avoid the fatigue effect and to be much more effective on this holistic approach is critical. So at L'Oréal, for example, we have set up a human rights internal committee, which gather folks and reps from the anti-corruption department, from legal, from CSR, from communication, etc. All the métiers that may be at stake with human rights to share a common approach as far as we can.
Okay, thank you. Yes, you're right. Solutions are not always easy, but the difficult solutions perhaps are the ones that we need to strive for. Adam, I've got a question for you. Comes back to conflict minerals. A number of our listeners have asked about this. How do you go about having good visibility of the conflict minerals in your supply chain, considering, as you mentioned, that they individually are a very small part of components, and you know, they're complex supply chains with all the manufacturing involved. So how do you get visibility of that?
Just to echo what another panelist said, Julie, what you said about MiCA is completely echoed with mineral sourcing. You know, there's a lot of, we'll get questions of, can we get these minerals outside of Central Africa, or should we? And the same exact types of incentives are there in terms of it is livelihood, if managed correctly, that can actually help people. Running away from the problem is not a solution. And your question is, how do you do it? There's a few things that I think that are very practical and need to be pointed out. One is, this is a wheel that's been invented. So there's no reason for any company, large or small, to think they have to start from scratch. And there is legislation in the US. There's the Dodd-Frank Law 1520, which has due diligence programs. There's a form called the CMRT, which is a conflict minerals, I don't remember the whole acronym, but I think it's reporting template, conflict minerals reporting template. And in Europe, legislation is being developed in this space, which will be enacted at the beginning of 2021. So there is a standard set. And that's, I think, an important point to be starting today. It's not necessarily where we started. We started with that exact question. How do you know what's in there? Where is it coming from? And all those questions. I think now there are better tools in place, and we want to make sure that that those are being taken advantage of. The other thing that we found absolutely critical for, and I think it would apply to any type of challenging sourcing question, is consortia. The consortia and the partnerships across industry and industries really is multiplicative, both in the power to influence, and that's what we're here trying to do, but also in the power to provide the kind of standards and transparency that Mary was talking about, is being able to not just say what you're doing, but say it in the same language that others are saying it, so that those stakeholders understand, and whether those stakeholders are NGOs or customers or whoever, understand what you're saying. So really being, to me, if there's the question is, how do you start? It's really looking at the standards, looking at the mechanisms that are there, looking at the consortia across industries and where that's going. As far as the products that you're actually selling, I think as a business, it being a component manufacturer, it is very difficult. It is to understand exactly what goes into your products and where they come from, because you're talking multiple layers into the supply chain. And if you're outsourced manufacturing, that becomes even harder, because you have you're relying on someone else's diligence and transparency. So the next strategy there is to find the choke point. So with Conflict Minerals, we really looked at the smelter point. Looking down at the mines is something that we are engaged in, but that's not where we really focus our diligence. It's at the smelter. So so those would be the pieces of advice. Just to kind of recap, that is consortia, the regulatory tools that are in place, whether or not they're in your region, they can still be exploited and used. And then the traceability analysis of what it is that you have in your products or your supply chain.
Sure. And I think your point around being able to identify the choke point is very important, because clearly companies with complex supply chains, thousands of suppliers potentially, you can't be on top and be monitoring everybody all the time. It's a question of knowing where the problems are going to be and focusing efforts on that. Mary, question for you. You mentioned the UN Guiding Principles as a useful framework and tool for assessing human rights in your opening remarks. So a number of questions about this. So how do you perceive the role of the UN Guiding Principles and due diligence in the future for ethical trade? And how do you use them? What's the kind of approach to using them in your business at VF? Mary?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, a lot of the legislation we see coming out on due diligence are directly tied to the UNGPs and the OECD guidance. So I think it's having a much bigger effect and will continue to have a bigger effect as time goes on. I think for us, I see the UNGPs almost as a roadmap for how to conduct due diligence. So it says, okay, you need to adopt policy commitments to protect human rights and assess the actual and potential human rights impacts. So, you know, that's what I was talking about, where we're doing our human rights risks impact and stakeholder consultations. And UNGPs specifically say everything you do should draw on the internal and expertise and consult with potentially affected groups. So I think that's the foundation for any evidence-based due diligence process. And we try to adhere to that very closely. And then, of course, once you get that evidence, you have to integrate the findings into relevant internal functions like sourcing, supply chain, and compliance, and then verify the effectiveness of your preventative efforts. And it's a logical process, and it lays it out, and it makes your actions evidence-based and measurable. And I think that's a real benefit of following the UNGPs.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed. Lots of questions on engagement and how to engage with suppliers, and also particularly those with your suppliers' workers or your supplier's workers. So, Julie, I wonder if you could answer this question. how do you engage with those that you're trying to help? You identify a particular risk, but how then do you engage with them to ensure that they are getting the help, that their lives and that they are being, you know, the remediation is working?
In fact, you can have a different approach depending on your question at stake on your stakeholders. But going back to your point on suppliers, I think it's important to get them on board and not having necessarily immediately a legal approach, you know, with a kind of a red flag with termination of contracts. You should start first to really go on a co-constructed approach and on a raising awareness approach together, tackling the challenges, because most of the suppliers, they want to learn. There are few, of course, that don't want, and then you will in the end terminate the contract, but at least really try to be on a common ground. So for example, we are organizing learning expeditions, you know, Suppliers Day, and many, you know, options where we include our suppliers to build together solutions to face very complex human rights issues. Because very often, as Adam said, you can't solve the issue isolated. So having a common ground approach with your peers or with your suppliers is really a good way to go ahead on these issues.
Indeed, so you have to be collaborative for these things to work. Materiality is another big issue, and it's featuring in your questions, audience. Keep them coming in. We'll get through as many as we can. Adam, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about materiality and how do you spot material risks? How do you know when they are becoming material? Because some things will become material that weren't previously material. How does that process work for you?
I think that's something that we've worked on and refined over time, and it's really kind of a process of going from perfect to good, and understanding that a lot of good results is much better than a few perfect results. I guess I didn't necessarily intend to do this, but I'll refer to minerals again. Is I have a risk assessment table that I use that looks at about 50 different minerals in our supply chain. So everything from raw materials to steel to copper and gold, and it really is based on a consortium analysis of risk in the world for those materials, I'll have. There's an element there that's a top five risk material for sourcing, but as a giant company with 100,000 employees, I use about 6 kilograms of that material per year. So the materiality of that risk is, I know it's important, but that's something where I can solve that, or at least be assured that my due diligence is actually fairly simple. I don't really need to become an expert in that particular element. Whereas copper, which is much more common in our products as well as our construction and our outsourced products, is a much more complicated supply chain. So it may have an inherently lower risk profile, but because of the materiality to our business, and our operations, and as a supply chain risk, it's a much higher factor. And then the other thing I think with materiality is understanding, you know, we can. If you say you can't do everything, that's not necessarily that's definitely not an excuse. What it is, it's a prioritization. And using that same example, I know that I can look at those areas where I've done that risk analysis and that materiality analysis, saying this is important to us, and then also look at the rest of the world and say, who else is it important to? Where are those due diligence efforts? Where are those standards being driven? So where in the case of minerals, where partner companies or someone like the London Metals Exchange or for industry associations are working on this, I know I have a head start and I can actually make some progress. Where there is importance to me as an industry and there hasn't been that effort, I can look at that as a place where work needs to be done, and it really is ends up being a place where we may need to take the mantle of leadership in order to get it done.
Okay, thanks very much, Adam. Got some questions now on the big topic for all supply chain issues and around auditing. I'd like to spend maybe 5 minutes on this with all the panel. We have a specific question. Do you think that social audits is a good approach to eliminating risk from human rights to supply chains? And if not, is there a better tool? Mary, to you first.
Sure. I would say social audits are an important component of due diligence. It's how you are able to identify specific instances and specific factories. I don't think, you know, as I've mentioned before, I think it's one tool in the toolbox of due diligence. And compliance audits combined with, for example, human rights risks assessments, traceability, stakeholder engagement, that creates a more fulsome due diligence process that provides a more comprehensive overview of what should be addressed.
Okay. Julie, same to you. I've heard someone say that auditing is the worst tool for finding out problems in your supply chain, apart from all the others. Do you agree with that? I mean, is it a bit of a blunt tool, or can it work?
I think I agree with Marie. It's an important tool. You can't skip from it. However, it's very important to be aware that it's not enough, because if not, you could go into a tick the box exercise, and it's problematic. So what is really important is not the audit itself, is to make sure that your auditors are equipped, are trained on human rights, for example, because human rights is at stake, and they know what they are talking about, and they are, you know, they have the capability and the skills to really challenge the suppliers when needed. This is one important point. So the skills of your auditors, and then also the follow up, because once you have identified issues, which is good, then you have to deal with it. And the most important part is really the after audit stuff. So audits are very important, as Marie said. However, it's not enough. So again, so how do you put tools in place to help your auditors and your buyers, by the way, also your internal audits, to be on board to deal with these complex issues? And going back to your previous question to Adam, you know, about material risks, it's also important, as Adam said, to prioritize, because you can't deal with everything. It's impossible. So you have to prioritize. And beyond, you know, the material scheme, you also have the salient human rights issue scheme provided by the UN Guiding Principles Reporting Framework. So you can focus on the risks and the issues that are the most severe, and also in terms of scale, and also in terms of remediability. You know, the issues that you can't remediate are very important to deal with prioritarily. So these are important points to bear in mind.
Thank you. It's a great point that it's not the audit that's important, it's what you do after the audit that's important. That's a really good point.
Yes.
Adam, same to you then. We hear an awful lot about auditing. We hear a lot about auditing audit fatigue in suppliers. What are the keys to make a social audit work well?
Well, I don't want to repeat what the strong points that Mary and Julie have just made, because I think they're exactly right. And so maybe to add to that, there's a couple of things. On I absolutely agree that the closure is critical, and maintaining a level of closure is critical. I also think that maintaining a level of responsibility on the company being audited. So at some point, not everyone is going to get a perfect grade. And the other piece about audits, which I think is inherently needs to be considered, is, you know, performance and building up good sustainability performance, whether it's human rights or safety or any of these other things, is an additive process. You're trying to do better and better every year. But when you get audited, it ends up being a subtractive process. And the example I always use is, we always talk about one critical issue in safety and human rights is exit doors, right? We just saw an issue 2 days ago in India. And if I have a factory with 100 doors and 98 of them are properly labeled and unblocked, I have a 98% success rate, but then my audit finds two priority findings that will go to all of my customers, and it's a real black mark on me. So it's that additive and subtractive, and really trying to make sure that the thoroughness, there's no excuses. However, we want to make sure that the thoroughness and the quality of the audit and those results are commensurate with what you're trying to achieve. And I think the other question that you mentioned on audit fatigue, one of the things that we have done with our customers, because we get audited quite a bit, and with some of our suppliers as well, is really trying to take approach of saying yes on our own terms. So for a high performing company, one of the ways you get paid for doing all this work and doing all these audits and having your operations interrupted is if you do well, then you can take those results and share them with your other customers. So is it kind of going back to your very, very introductory question of how is the bar being raised? How are the stakeholders increasing their scrutiny? That applies to our suppliers as well. So more of their customers care, more of their investors care, more people care. And by having the quality audit data available and sharing that transparently, you can actually tell them, no, I will not do your other audit, but here is a set of data that is verifiable, that is reliable, that really reflects what we're doing here. We're not hiding anything. If there are any additional questions or concerns you have, we're happy to do that. And that's saying yes on our own terms is something that to empower the suppliers and to increase that partnership and to lower the overall cost of sustainability and of human rights is an approach that I think isn't universal, but it's something that we can continue to grow.
And what are the things to look out for when you are talking about data sharing? Obviously, you can be very careful there, haven't you, around what data, the pre-competitive argument comes into play. So what are the kind of key things to watch out for when you are talking about the possibility of sharing data with different parties?
When we ask for an audit, we very rarely will go in and perform the audit ourselves. We will work with third parties. We'll work with consortia. We're very, because we're electronics and we're founders, we're very tied in with the Responsible Business Alliance. But there's other equivalents that are strong in other industries. So it's just an example of not the only version, and that systematizes a way that if I request an audit for a supplier and that gets scheduled, I have access to that data. But the supplier is the one who really owns that data, and then they can send it out to whoever they want without me knowing anything about it. And as that system drives, I ended up last year with about 45% more audit data than I asked for. Because my suppliers were doing audits for other customers, saw that data, sent it to us, and we're able to help support them improve. Help support them with that data without asking. And so that standardization perpetuates both the effectiveness and quality of the audit.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you very much, Adam. Obviously, keeping in top of where your impacts are being felt most in your supply chains and also where your human rights risks are is very important. We've had a lot of questions about mapping in particular. So, Mary, I wonder if I could ask you first, what is your process for keeping your human rights impacts mapping up to date? A lot of potential data points there. How do you keep on top of that?
Are you talking about our traceability or our internal tracking of human rights?
Your mapping of impacts in your supply chain.
We do that. We work with a couple of consultants, the Article 1 consultants and Verite, to map out where our human rights risks are and then overlay that in a heat map with our traceability. So it's a complex and continuous process that we we look at revise and then reassess and conduct again.
Sure. And are there any sort of any particular things that you think a company that's setting out in this process should look out for when they're first approaching it?
I mean, I think evidence based and consistency, making sure that you're identifying the problems and prioritizing them by prevalence and egregiousness, and then making your prioritization from there.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Something else that's coming up a lot is thinking about anti-corruption and aligning human rights efforts with anti-corruption efforts. Julie, I wonder if you get any comments on how you do that with L'Oréal. You know, obviously anti-corruption is a massive concern for many businesses, but how do you align and integrate your anti-corruption efforts with human rights efforts? Or if you don't, why not?
Yes, we are trying the most we can to have a common approach. Not always easy, not for everything, but at least it's really a good thing we want to continue to work on. For example, when we are acquiring new targets, new companies, and we have a lot of merger and acquisition activity at L'Oréal, we have a common, we call it ethical approach, but it covers anti-corruption issues and also human rights issues. So we have started with M&A, merger and acquisition, and then we are trying to duplicate this common ground approach going to supply chain, for example, to the audits we are doing. We try to have a common approach also.
Thank you. Several questions about working with new suppliers. Adam, I wonder if you could answer this quickly. When you are working with new suppliers, how do you assess them? Any tips as to kind of how to quickly assess any new human rights risks that may come from a new supplier? What does the process look like for you? And Mary, I'd like to ask you that as well. So, but Adam first.
I think there's a couple different things. I would say there's an ecosystem approach. Many years ago, when China was really emerging as the center for original device manufacturing, we had a lot of big events. So where we would really try to bring in supplier companies and prospective suppliers to help educate. This is what our standards are. This is where we need to be. We still do those sort of things. We held one for about 40 companies last year to even in maturing markets. We've also driven that model into the consortia. So there are outreach events around the world, essentially every quarter now. So there's that kind of that broad outreach space. Another place where I would say kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, where it's a one-on-one and maybe the most challenging, is when we buy a company, we're buying their supply chain. So in the M&A space, we get new suppliers that we have not been able to vet. We have not been able to give them those rules, and essentially they're all instantly signed up to a contractual code of conduct that maybe they haven't actually ever heard of or even read. That becomes a real challenge, and we need to be careful and cognizant, because a existing supplier that is violating that code of conduct, we can take action against them and really drive that. For a brand new supplier that came from a different direction, it can take a long time, but we really need to be very careful and diligent about suppliers that we don't know much about. And oftentimes we're not doing the kind of business that we are, like Mary said, with some of her core suppliers to really have that influence. So it is that path of education, assessment, audits, and support in order to get these things solved. And sometimes it can take a long time.
Okay, no, thank you, Adam. Thank you, Adam. Mary, do you have anything to add to that? Tips for assessing new suppliers?
Actually, I think they have a very similar process to Intel, where we audit the company to identify the risks before we let them enter our supply chain. We overlay that with the potential human rights risks brought to us by our risk assessments, and then we overlay that with the minimum requirements for our factories. And through that engagement, we provide support to our factories or to the potential factories to help them understand and meet our expectations, including our global compliance and principles and codes of conduct. So it sounds very similar.
Okay, no, thank you. Thank you for that. Coming towards the end of our time, a couple of things I want to cover. I think this next question really hits the nail on the head in terms of the problems and the challenges businesses have. Our questioner asks if you can give an example of a time you've reconciled a difference between a risk that is not financially material to your business, but yet is a real human rights risk, and how do you reconcile that? Julie?
Yes, it's a good question again, because sometimes internally colleagues can say, look, we are a business, we are not an NGO, so we are supposed to assess the risk for the company and not the risk we are generating on others. Fair point. However, my answer is generally to say, but the risk we are causing on others is a risk on ourselves. So it's a way, you know, to reconcile sometimes this approach. And also, as we mentioned earlier, there are more and more expectations, as Adam said. So expectations from our consumers, investors, etc. Now we have to comply with these expectations. So it's reconcile the financial and the so-called non-financial vision, because the non-financial issues becomes also financial issues pretty soon. So it's a way to answer.
Okay, thank you. Adam, do you want to, same question. Can you give an example of reconciling differences between a risk that's financially, not financially material, but yet is a significant human rights risk?
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think there's anything that you can say is not financial material, because if you're looking at addressing risks, and you know, if you think of a spectrum from risks that can really hurt you up to addressing something proactively in a way that can really help you, I would really just echo that is really looking at the constituents that you have, particularly for your customers, because if you're putting your customers at risk, then that's not acceptable. Closing that risk, maybe those dollars never get materialized or quantified, but it helps support the infrastructure, saves costs down the line, and saves and fits with your most demanding customers. I know my colleagues here have very demanding customers in these areas, and we want to make it easier and cheaper for the entire supply chain.
Okay, I've got a final question I want to put to all of the panel. Let's go back to our central question, talking about the future. And I really would like each of the panel just to give us one quick thing that they want to see business doing more of in the coming year to address human rights and ethical trade. Mary, coming to you first. So one thing.
I would say working together, brands working together, cross-sectoral working together, working with stakeholders to create a comprehensive approach to some of these really intractable human rights risks.
Thanks, Mary. Adam?
I would say the same thing. You know, I've run into people from companies like VF and L'Oreal at events within supply chain management, within Gartner, and some of these other things that bring companies together, and continuing to drive both the risk abatement as well as the value that CSR brings, and human rights is core to all of that.
Okay, thank you. And Julie, finally to you.
No, I really echo what has just been said. If we work all together, we will prevent a lot of abuses or breaches or even fatigue, you know, going back to your point on social audits. If we share the audits together with the help of third parties to prevent any risk and competitive issue, I think this is a solution to be explored more.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Julie. I'm going to have to bring the discussion to a close as we're running out of time. Thanks so much for our panel for their time and their insight today. Don't forget that similar issues will be discussed by experts at Innovation Forum's Ethical Trade and Human Rights Conference Series in London on the 18th and 19th of March and in New York on the 5th and 6th of May. And if you register this week for London, you will save £200 on conference passes. We will be in touch to share a recording of this webinar so you can listen to it again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. But for now, I hope you found the past hour interesting. I've been Ian Welsh, and thank you for joining us.